bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
That's me.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everyone. That's me.
So, gentlemen, we're here on a very uneventful day. The world's just moving on forward as normally we would expect it to.
A normal episode of Weird Things with the normal three hosts that it always is.
Yeah. So we've been talking about the whole COVID-19 story for a while, and of all the people to listen talk about it, we're probably the least informed people to hear talk about it. So we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
And
I hear you get it through winking.
Yes. That was XKCD had a funny comic about like how, you know, they're going to have, you know, this meeting, like, oh, we're going to have to change our habits. So no more licking each other on the eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing a wave of cancellations and stuff. We talked about, I think last week we'd already said, you know, South by Southwest had been postponed or canceled, whatever. Yeah. And, you know, those are the things that, you know, those precautionary measures are probably smart because, you know, you're trying to figure things out. We're still trying to understand, you know, about, you know, the virus. And, you know, some things we find out make us go, oh, okay, not as scary as we think. And then some things make you go, oh, well, that's concerning. And so that's that real thing of mixed news. And one of the things that, like, society and markets and things like that hate is uncertainty. And that's what you see right now with the stock market, is this uncertainty. And if you think about it rationally, though, you know, the point I was making to a friend yesterday was, okay, so the stock market, you know, was going to go down, and the stock market took a big hit last week, and today it took an even bigger hit. Like, if you're betting that things don't get better, then nothing gets better. You know, there is no more stock market. So it kind of was like, I think I didn't get into like a selling pan. I just bought some shares and some stuff right before we started, you know, live here. But like, it's one of these things where you're thinking like, well, if you think it's going to just, everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket, then, you know, then everything ends.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the situation you get in with something like this, where obviously there's supply lines are disrupted via COVID, travels disrupted via COVID. But you know, unless this brings out other gigantic underlying systemic problems, which I am not a financial analyst smart enough to know whether it does, then this is something that will rebound. Like we will get back to where we were if this is just about the momentary problems that are being created by this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's the, we don't know enough to know what, you know, it was how we should react. Like, there was Elon Musk had a tweet the other day, which was, and it got heat from people saying that, like, the coronavirus panic is dumb. And I'm like, yeah, panic is dumb. That's not the same as saying there's nothing to worry about or everything's going to be fine or nobody's going to die. But saying that panic is dumb. Yeah, I agreed. And it was funny as I saw some people criticize him for that. And it's like, oh, are you saying panic is not dumb?
No. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much energy I have to comb through the reaction to Elon Musk's reaction, but I do think that there is a healthy understanding beyond the initial, hey, we need to make sure that we are taking different precautions. We need to think about where we're traveling. I totally am sympathetic to some of these organizations that are canceling stuff out of an abundance of caution. Apparently, the reason why this is the Wuhan virus is partially because there was like a 40,000 person potluck that was the initial moment that this kind of hit a sort of a larger escape velocity that then coupled with Lunar New Year led people all over, everybody traveled all over the country. And next thing you know, we're dealing with this global issue. So, despite the fact that, you know, my half-price European vacation that I was going to take in 2 months is now off the table because Twitch canceled TwitchCon Europe, you know, I get it. I totally understand why people are doing this. But I also think, you know, that in general, being aware means being aware, and being aware means understanding 2% mortality rate.
I have from the onset been critical of people saying who've been downplaying it. I remember I was on, I spent 2 weeks ago, I was on Twitter getting on the case of about, of, you know, of a Yahoo News article that was like, we were worried about the flu. Cause I'm like, be vigilant, be careful, and don't assume we know. And that's been my point. But I guess my point, the other side of it is, it's like, that also means like, don't overreact. You know, sure. There's unreaction. And that's been my frustration, is that there were people a while ago who were like, chill out, everybody, nothing to worry about. Like, no, we don't know. And then now it's also, I'm on the other side saying like, yeah, but also like, don't change your life plans for the rest of your life right now. And like, literally, panic is dumb, and because panic causes bad problems. That's what the problem is when we overreact, you know, then that's when things can get even worse.
And, you know, and also, I don't know, the talking point that I heard a lot was like, well, it's less, you know, a lower mortality rate than the flu. Now I think it's maybe changed since that was the talking point, but it's like, yeah, we don't want two flus. Like, we can actually want both of these things to not happen and not kill people, but equally maybe don't go out to the supermarket and destroy the stock of hand sanitizers, because you'll probably be fine.
Or toilet paper. This is like the real thing. People are just buying toilet paper like it's going out of style. Which, I'll tell you what, folks, just go get a hose. Go to Home Depot, get a hose. You're going to be, I'll tell you what.
Drink it straight from the tap, baby.
That's going to run out a lot, yeah, a lot later than the toilet paper is. Get one of those guns, man. You're good to go.
The thing I'm optimistic about, one is, I think that of... there's you know, every viral strain, there's this little randomization that comes there and how it can affect the host and what it can do. And, you know, you're a few sequences away from something that has a much higher mortality rate or something that's much worse or whatever. And we could, you know, based on what we think we know now, you know, we're finding out the mortality rate's not as high as we thought, but still it targets certain groups. And it's scary, because if you're elderly or some of the at-risk people, you know, you can't just be like, well, I'm young and healthy, no problem. Like, no, you know, that's why you're seeing such high mortality rates in places like Iran and Italy, where they have large segments of older population and whatnot. And that's bad news. If, you know, if you like people, there's a lot of people that are at risk. And so finding these things out will be helpful in the long run. You know, there's always been in the world of epidemiology, they've talked about the idea of like disease X or something. You know, what if you had something that had a mortality rate of like Ebola or whatever, but had a longer sort of cycle so that it could spread further? And Ebola has been devastating in Africa. That's one of the things we sort of forget, because like, well, it's over there, but, you know, we've had, you know, tens of thousands of people have died from this thing, and finally we have a cure for this thing. But this has been just wreaking havoc in areas of their pockets there for years. But you take something like this that can spread, you know, worldwide, where it has a much higher mortality rate, whatever, all the wrong factors to make something very deadly. This is a good wake-up call to say, hey, yeah, no, we need to think a lot more about this, you know. And I've been frustrated personally, like, with the way the CDC has had mission creep, where, you know, the Center for Disease Control spends tons of time and resources on things that are not infectious or inherited diseases, but things like on gun violence and stuff like that, which I certainly think we should be investigating. But I don't think, you know, it's the purview of, like, you know, the CDC, because it's not a disease in the real sense. And that's been frustrating, is watching things like that, where we only put resource into things when we think that they're a real threat. And now that we're seeing how much havoc this can cause, hopefully moving forward, you know, we will handle this appropriately. You know, it's a black swan event to say, yeah, the next one could be really, really, really bad.
Yeah, I mean, it is always a good idea for us to figure out the best way to try to contain diseases like this, whether it's mild or, but you know, while it's a quote unquote mild disease versus something like a disease X, where suddenly, you know, we haven't had a global event of this scale in, who knows, in for however long, longer than I am aware of. And for as much as we have, like, say, fire safety drills and tornado drills, we should at least have a plan and general guidelines for, like, okay, here's what you should do if we believe that there is, like... Like there are what is it? Burn bans and burn ratings for throughout every day, you know, based on your location and the weather. Like it would be weird and maybe impractical, but it would not be crazy to have a level of preparedness at that level for infectious disease, right?
Yeah, at the very least, I think. Hand washing. I'm sure more people are washing their hands, you know, but it is frustrating. Like I went to a movie Saturday night because I'm like, oh, I'm going to go to the movies and sort of support the movies and stuff because, you know, I think as long as, you know, I'm not, you know, getting breathed on by everybody else, everything's fine. And yeah, I walk into the bathroom, use the restroom as I'm leaving. I see a guy who spent a long time in the stall, walk out, stop, look at the sink and just sort of do this and just grab the door handle and walk straight up, you know, and you're like, what? What kind of sociopath are you, dude? You know, and you see that a lot. You see that a lot where I think that behavior may be changing a bit. More stores with, you know, I sort of get frustrated because it's like I want to go on about like how idiotic I think plastic bag bans are, like how they do absolutely zero for the environment and actually make things more unhealthy because you know, are using, you know, reusable bags don't get washed. And there's evidence to show there's an increase in foodborne infections when you do that. I would love the effort that went into that to put hand sanitizers and stuff into every store. You walk into a place, there's sanitizer, there's that. I would love if that was, you know, the outcome of this was we make it much easier to not get infected by other people's bad habits.
Yeah, I mean, I hope.
So
where are you at on, you know, some of these closures of events and cancellations of events? The report is today that the NBA is having a meeting that is laying out on the table that they possibly would play some or all games in empty arenas with only a very specific people on the team allowed, not even the full a roster that they would bring, you know, in terms of their staff. What do you think that's overcautious?
I don't, without the information to know, I don't know. I think the cancellation of other events and stuff is probably prudent because we don't have enough information. I think that sporting events, things like this, where people are going to be exposed to each other for a period of time, but not, you know, in a convention, people are shaking hands, you're pressing up against each other. That's the same too of an NBA game, I guess, to a point, you know, where you're going in and out. But, you know, you go in and then you sit in one spot and it's not like you're mingling with, you know, at a convention, you're going to come in close contact to 60 or 70 people every 10 minutes, you know. And I would be curious to hear the opinion of an epidemiologist or somebody who could say, like, you know, what's safe there versus not there, whatever. But I think that if you take right precautions and stuff, like, you know, if you we went to the movies and it wasn't a super crowded theater and, you know, careful enough to what we touched and whatever. But it was frustrating, though, because when you walk into a movie theater and you see that there's food and stuff still sitting in the seats because they didn't clean it and, you know, they certainly didn't sanitize it. I think that's the sort of thing to be mindful of. And I think that we should not be afraid to shame places like this. Like, if you want us to come to the movies, clean your effing seats. You know, let me know that the person who sat here before, you know, didn't spend the last 2 hours coughing on the seat. And I think that places where they can take precautions, fine. But I don't know. I kind of think that I think we should let people sort of, some of those things, do things at their own risk. The problem with conventions is sometimes you're compelled to go because of work or whatever. And you don't want to go, and you don't want to have to go to, you know, if you're somebody who's hired to go work at South by Southwest, it's frustrating if you're forced to go to this thing. We're an NBA game, you know, the employees and people have to work there, but.
Well, I think also South by was a very unique situation because, yes, there is a conference, but the conference and in the convention center is very expensive and, you know, people don't spend a lot of time there. Right. You know, yeah. They might go see a panel or two, but most of that event, and I still wonder how much even the city of Austin saying that it's canceled is going to be able to stop the fact that there are bands that just come down there and play for a week. And I don't know how people are going to be able to stop the fact that Austin's a live music capital and so much of Sixth Street is built around that.
And the South by situation is still unfolding. They sent emails out saying that they would not if you purchased a wristband, it would be deferred to next year. But then the South by CEO was out there saying, we don't know if we're going to do an event next year or if we can, because even if they offer no refunds on wristbands, there are still plenty of losses between vendors and broken contracts, ticket sales, drink sales, minimums, like any, like it is more than just the consumer's tickets. But even still, it's still evolving, and you know, they're saying they want to do some like online stuff, which I think would be good for like the film stuff, but it's such a weird thing. And the frustrating thing is that it doesn't much like the stock market, it is all a lot of uncertainty. You know, they sent out this email saying, well, we're going to do this online thing. We might do something later in 2020. We will defer your wristbands to 2021. But four different things, none of which are the plan. There's not a plan. It's all we're looking at it. We're thinking about it. We're talking about it.
Because even then, I mean, South by Southwest, by all reporting, was an organization that lived year to year. Like, there wasn't a lot of money making in between when they put on this conference. And there is going to be a question of whether or not South by Southwest, at least in the organization that we know it, is going to be able to survive, whether it's going to have to maybe be another kind of organization that comes in to run it going forward. And beyond that, like, there's just no way to make up for it, right? Because, like, anything that you would say before, even to defer to next year, you still have a problem because they needed the money next year to run next year.
Right. What do you guys think about the 2020 Olympics that are supposed to start in July, I believe? I know that the IOC, my understanding is the IOC has been very mum about saying the words alternatives, because I think some people have said that there are possible contingencies within their contracts, but I think it's very smart of them to not even give wiggle room or talk about any decisions yet until they make one.
To understand what goes into building for an Olympics is, I mean, this is
billions of dollars. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it is gigantic. And they've been preparing for this for years and years and years. The last I heard from the IOC was that there were no alternatives. This was going to be, if it's not run in Tokyo this summer, it will be canceled. Like, now, whether or not that will actually happen is one, you know, who knows. The other side is like, you can't just move the Olympics, right? like there's a lot of time and effort that goes into making a place ready for that. And I don't know if there's really any, I mean, maybe, you know, there are elements of here in the United States that have enough stadiums and stuff like that you could run it, but I don't know if the United States would be like, yes, no, we want the potential risk.
Right.
Well, yeah, and it's the idea of doing holding events and then not having the spectators. And I think, you know, July is a long enough way out that, you know, the next few weeks, the next couple months or so, you know, are going to be interesting as far as what we find out. And, you know, and it's one of the things where you even look at, like, you know, the initials first, you know, mortality rates were looking at 2 or 3% were scary, because that's, you know, that's obviously, you know, you take a classroom, you know, that's one person, that's terrifying. And yeah, now we think that it's probably less than that, but also, like, you know, we're just the lack of tests and stuff is problematic. But as we get more data on that, then we probably be able to think through and say, okay, because I think we're going to reach a point where we're going to say, like, we need to go into public, we need to do public events, we need to do stuff. And, you know, let's not make them compulsory, but let's allow people to decide on their own, you know, like, you know.
You know, the question is, so let's take Austin for example. Austin is a growing city. By all accounts, it is kind of straining against the infrastructure that was built for it years ago. And that would likely include hospitals and you know, medical personnel. And especially if you had something like South by, if you had an outbreak on the level of something that, like, happened in Wuhan in Austin, that's a big problem. It's a big kind of health challenge. I get why the city of Austin, by all accounts, stepped in and said, no, we're going to have to be the bad guy if South by won't cancel it by themselves, because it's basically them committing economic suicide. then the city would have to be the bad guy. The question is, going forward, when does that flip? Like, you know, because no matter what, the mayor's going to get, nobody wants to be the mayor of Amityville, right? Like, you know, or, you know, they want to make sure that these things go on. The question is, when that's not a political and safety problem.
Yeah. I mean, there's a similar issue for Los Angeles with E3 coming up in June. E3 already is kind of like in a shaky position based on how things have gone the past couple of years. And this is going to be a big year because Sony and Microsoft are going to have new consoles. New hardware at the end of this year. And E3 is the place where you make a lot of stink about it, and not just the public stuff that the public sees, but also like industry stuff behind closed door meetings. And if E3 doesn't happen this year, like more so than like the danger of South by Southwest coming back next year, if E3 doesn't happen this year, I think there's a better than 50% chance it never comes back, because it has already got reduced ticket sales. People are doing stuff digitally, yeah, and it's working, you know, in terms of promotion. And this, you know, this is another big deal where, you know, thousands of people go, and if something just clicks right, suddenly it's another, you know, pot of disease.
I think that E3, talk about like the stock market. If the stock market is reacting to coronavirus, then the stock market will come back. If the coronavirus then reveal some over leveraged positions with, you know, that are a problem with the stock market, then it's going to have a harder time recovering. To me, whether or not it's called South by Southwest next year, or whether or not that organization has to sell the branding to somebody else that's got more money and can start fresh,
there'll be something.
People will want to come to Austin in March and see live music and do something, right?
In like here-
that's the thing. E3, that's, I think, there are systemic problems to E3. Everything that you said, if it goes away, it will hasten a process that was already in motion.
Yeah. The way of Comdex or some of those other big trade shows, it sort of eventually sort of run their course as the industry sort of mature past where they are.
You guys. Oh no, he's getting sick. He's getting sick live.
Over the microphone.
The thing, I think the most likely thing that's going to happen is, you know, right now we've talked about we have a lot of potential vaccines in testing, which by next year, next COVID-19 season, you know, you'll probably be able to go get a shot for that. Before then, we're looking at therapies for ways to treat it. And there's a lot of research being done right now to look at, like, how do you treat this? How do you limit the effect of this when it enters the body? And there's stuff on, like, you know, protease inhibitors and other things like that are being done to try to figure out how to lessen the impact of it. And we're going to start seeing, we're already seeing some research articles coming out now saying this is already something that's been a tested thing that looks effective. And part of it's just the initial chaos where you have the first patients and we're one, and some, you had cases where hospitals were like, the CDC is like, oh no, this person's not in the group, we don't need to test them. And then like, oh, whoops. Turn out our data on who was infected, whatever, wasn't accurate, and maybe we do need to do this. Now's not really, I think, the best time for finger-pointing kind of stuff, because our information is going to be very uneven, and you see a lot of that in the press, like, oh, X should have done this, or X should have done, and I've certainly done this with my own criticism right now, the CDC with mission creep, but I will stand by that. But, you know, we don't know what we know, and there was a lot of stuff like, oh, we should have done this, but we didn't know what was reliable, and even still, you had the CDC was saying that we wanted to be the official source for the statistics on that, and they were the only ones that could give the test for it, which was problematic because there was just one, their own test that seems like there are issues with it, and they were only able to test so many people, and they weren't testing people outside of that. And that's when Mike Pence and the group there said, no, we're going to let anybody who's capable of giving the test give the test, because right now we need to know. And even having this one single source of information may be helpful from a research point of view, but it's not helpful from, you know, you're a hospital in Portland, Oregon going, does this person have it? Like, well, can we test? Well, let's send it to the CDC and wait. Meanwhile, your physicians and nurses are afraid to treat a person, you know? So things are in flux. what will eventually happen, more likely than not, is we're going to find short-term treatments, treatments that help you if you get the condition. We're also increasing the number of tests for it. So if somebody starts displaying flu-like symptoms, you'll go to the hospital, you'll get checked, and they'll be like, oh, shoot, you have this. Here's the course of treatment we use, which increases your chance of survival dramatically. And over the next few months, that's likely going to be the case of what's going to happen. At that point, the uncertainty, the chaos starts to settle a bit, and we get a lot more certainty about it. And then we'll be looking at things very differently. So, you know, I think the likely path is a few months from now, you know, we're going to have know a lot more, and it's going to be less scary, either because of what we know or because of the treatments in place to handle it.
Well, here's what's also less scary. A world in which you donate to patreon.com/weirdthings. Patreon.com/weirdthings is the number one place that you can make sure that we continue to give you this kind of informative discussion about matters big and small. Head on over there, patreon.com/weirdthings today.
That's right.
So let's get some perspective here. I want to ask you guys, maybe you're hoping for a simpler time.
Yes, that's what I often long for. I find myself thinking of simpler times.
Horse-drawn carriages and cookies in a paper bag.
Yeah. I want to go even simpler. Let's go back to the Mediterranean about 13,000 years ago.
Hell yeah, that's simple as hell.
Well, lush climate, you know? Greenery as far as you can see. It's not the environment we see today. This is a very, very different environment, which was just...
Not like the ratty Mediterranean of 2020. Get out of here.
Stop smoking cigarettes and, you know, yelling at each other. Not enough. I want simpler.
Make
than
it
that.
Simple, baby.
Well, you're not... You know, nobody's getting canned. I mean, you might get shunned, but you're nobody's getting... Wow, did the more... Did how the ancient people invented canceling. You know, so, you know, nobody's getting canceled. You know, you're not dealing with people you've never met trolling you, whatever. It's kind of an idyllic sort of life. You know, you spend your time fishing and perhaps farming.
I bet you those people didn't even have Twitter on their phone, man. Like, that's how they are.
That's real
Blackberry
simple.
Blackberry at best, you know. Yeah,
that's simple.
Simple. Yeah.
You're not even really farming at this point. It's more kind of maybe some horticulture and stuff. And so, you know, you're eating some maybe herding
essential
and stuff.
Essential oils right here on the clavicle. That'll heal you up right now.
Yeah. You know,
horticulture.
Simple stuff.
We all have bronze skins because of the sun and the weather. And it's just, it's chill. I mean, we're probably going to, you know, Justin and I would probably be dead by now, Bryce. But, you know, you as the elder grandfather in the village.
That's right. I'd be on the backswing of my time. Okay, the Mediterranean. I'm trying to get ahead of you. What could this possibly be?
I'm saying sounds cool, sounds chill. You know,
I'm already more relaxed just thinking about it.
Yeah. Togas, sandals.
I'm feeling very, very, very simple.
I love it
right now.
And I'm going to tell you that, you know, this is 13,000 years ago, so you got a couple more thousand years before massive sea level change and this big barrier gives way in the Mediterranean, flooding through and giving birth to, like, you know, flood legends. We're a ways away from that right now. So
I'm not even thinking about it, dude. Like, right now, I got a simple mind with simple plans.
Simping out.
So we're out there. We're out there playing a game of stick.
I love stick. Yeah. Oh, man. Simple game.
Yeah. Take a stick. You throw a stick.
Yeah, man.
Get the stick. You have a stick. It's so great.
I got the stick now. I'm going to throw it.
Hey, I want that stick.
Nice throw. That backspin was great.
Simple.
Yeah. Man, is that a saber-toothed tiger print there?
Yeah.
I don't know. What's a saber-toothed tiger? I just have big cats. Don't care. Don't know.
I have no idea what's going on at all, dude. All I know is I pick up a stick, I throw the stick, and then I go to sleep.
Night. And then hey, you get a little knock on your hut. Hey, Justin, want to play some stick?
Hell yeah, I'm awake. Let's go. That's what I do for a living. I don't know how this economy works, but it's very simple.
Sun's out, hey, sticks out. It's easy.
Hey, so what about God's eye? That was pretty cool, wasn't it, last night? I was watching it all night long. He just gets bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man. Definitely believe in God's eye. God's yeah. eye's happening. That's what happens when stick time is done. God's eye comes out. And that's the thing. I can't really tell you that I saw it, though, because I went to sleep after stick. You know, that's kind of my thing.
Stick wore him out.
Yeah. Oh, I get so tuckered out, man. I play stick hard. I sleep hard.
The good news is we can actually see God's eye right now during the day. Come on. Let's take a look.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
What am I Chieftain at? Bryce, come on out here. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'm doing this with my hands, but we don't have binoculars yet, so I'm just looking.
One day, we'll make a thing called glass, and you'll hold that in your hands over your eyes. Does God's eye look bigger today?
I don't know. Ooh. Maybe. Glass. What are you, George Jetson? That's a name I just invented for idiots.
Oh, that sounds like a very unsimple name, Justin.
Oh yeah, it's what. That's why I
unbefitting of our time.
Yeah,
God's eye. It does look a little. It does look. We don't have a unit of measurement, I don't think, but it looks like a bit bigger than maybe it did the last time we looked at it, and it ended.
Your hand up to it. You always know. You can always relatively say to your hand, right? How much of Bryce's hand is God's eye today?
Wow. I mean, it started to spread. Oh, ow. What was that? Oh, wait, what's that sound? Oh, geez. Is this hail? Wait, nope. Oh, guys, you know, there's probably a thing called a comet, and I think a comet is actually impacting. Oh, man.
Oh, no.
Boom, gone.
Our Done. Simple lives.
My skin!
So researchers have been looking at, you know, there've been some periods of, periods of which we've watched, you know, massive impacts, or we've seen things that happened that had like an environmental impact where we're trying to figure out what caused it, what have you. And there was a period about 12,800 years ago. So this would be, you know, over, you know, 10,000 years ago, where we think there may have been an impact, and evidence is sort of worldwide with, and we think it may have actually been a comet, and not an asteroid, but a comet that impacted and actually probably wiped away. They found this evidence of a civilization in Abu Huraya, which it looks like that may have been the end of those people there, because they may have been a little bit too close.
Wow. And we're only just now discovering this. I thought we had a pretty good sense of all the times that the Earth had a little run-in with comets.
Well, asteroids, things like this, we find out a lot more. But they think that there was evidence of like a village that would have been abruptly destroyed, and they found some evidence of, they found evidence of like other places where they look like there may have been an impact burn, and so here it seems pretty clear, like up until a point there's like no more like village stops, and there's like bits of molten glass and other pieces around that imply that there was. An impact, which in this case would have been very likely from a comet. So there you go, guys. Perspective.
Could definitely be crushed by a comet.
Yeah.
That's definitely a thing that could happen at any moment.
We don't need to worry about the Black Plague, because if a comet comes, it would be much worse.
Don't wash your hands, because you could get killed by a comet at any time, and you want to be one with the Earth.
Yeah. So the headline from this is it's fizz.org. Researchers find evidence of a cosmic impact that caused destruction of one of the world's earliest human settlements. You know, we're sitting here with our proud houses, our huts, and our game of stick.
Yeah,
love stick.
We're living the life.
We're the height of achievement here, guys. The height of achievement. I went over to another village. They got twig.
Stig.
Simpletons.
A-holes. Bunch of George Jetsons.
Ooh, we have small stick. It's small stick.
Yes. But, you know, it is the thing I think about. Like, I've got a Neanderthal hand axe here that, like, is something like 300,000 years old.
With you? And on hand?
Yeah, I got it here in my bag. I got a...
Wait, he's going into his bookshelf. What the
hell? Here we go. Yeah. Boom.
Oh. Well, it looks like an arrowhead, but much bigger.
Yeah. This is a... This was sort of the iPhone for Neanderthals. This was your super multi-tool, you know, and so it was actually sharper and stuff. So you could use it to scrape, you could use it to pound, you could use it to do a lot of different things. You could smash things with it, whatever. It was very useful.
Wow.
They find these. They're not that rare because remember, the Neanderthals were living in Europe, Eurasia, and whatnot for hundreds of thousands of years longer than Homo sapiens sapiens. So they were there much longer, and they used, the average Neanderthal went through several of these in a lifetime. And so you know, you'd make one, you'd use one. When it got dull, you got rid of it, got another one, whatever. You lost one, whatever. So they're litter bugs. So these are not terribly hard to find.
Oh, wow.
But you think about this. This was, and I try to appreciate the fact, this was held by, you know, a, you know, well, I mean, I'm European, so an ancestor of sorts. But an offshoot, you know, another species held this. To think about this, another species, wow, intelligent species, offshoot, held this, but somebody 300,000 years ago held this tool.
Incredible.
And to get a sense of deep time, you think about this, you know, 300,000 years later, mm-hmm, here I am holding this. 300,000 years from now, you know, somebody can be holding my stupid coffee mug here or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You know,
it's going to be holding my ember mug saying, like, can you believe another species held this at one time?
Yeah. Can you believe what this idiot paid for this thing?
Exactly. I know. Anyway, let's play a game of mug.
Yes. But it gives you, I mean, it certainly gives you perspective on things like that to think about. It's just that, like, holy cow, like 300,000 years from now, you know,
what is going to remain? Well, yeah.
I can't even fathom. I mean, I, you know, we talk about singularity, everything else like that, but that's just that how deep time is, how little time we have, how quickly time passes is just sort of amazing.
It's interesting because of so much of human life has become digital, and I wonder how much is going to get lost in the next 300,000 years, right? Like, all of this digital data that we've got, like, at some point it could become obsolete, right? Like, hey, mm-hmm, MP3s, what are those ancient files?
I mean, if you even think that there are elements of our digital past that are already kind of gone forever, you know, like sites, well, you used to go to, and like even in their recovered versions, they're never the same as they were in the moment that you enjoyed it.
Well, but I mean, I'll give you another kind of Bryce, what's your ancestry?
Mexican.
Okay, so it's interesting because you say Mexican. Now, Mexican, as we know, is sort of a modern invention. You know, Mexican implies that you're probably Spanish and part Indian, right? And how much do you know of your Indian ancestry?
Zero. I know barely any of my Mexican ancestry.
Okay. Yeah. Now, where were your, you know, where, like, were your great-great-grandparents were from? What region or what have you?
Mm-mm. No, I don't. I haven't done any of that stuff. I know nothing. I know nothing.
So you have...
And that's only a couple hundred years, maybe, if that.
So you have part of your, a good part of your ancestors were here for 20,000 years and had culture. And, you know, depending if you know, we have the more recent, you know, like a group like the Aztecs and Mayans, but going further back and all those other regional smaller groups there was entire lores, languages, histories, epics, things like this that are completely gone. You know, a part of what happened is when, you know, the conquistadors came to, you know, the Americas, one, you already had, there was already a decline, there was some sort of collapse going on, but once we introduced European diseases and brought European-style warfare, whatever, and everything else that impacted that, and then you would look at the spread of TB and these diseases and stuff, where you had humongous, you know, this apocalypse that just affected so much of the continents, both of them, and wiped away so many people, and we don't know what we lost, you know, and then, you know, your ancestors were the survivors, who then got together with other survivors and formed new coalitions and new groups and stuff. But so much of that history is just gone. And that's true of everybody. I mean, everybody, you know, from wherever you're from, there's that story that's been played out throughout. And so we think about what we're losing now, what we lost.
Yeah.
You know, there was, whoever had this, they had a language. Whoever, I'm holding the hand axe, they had a language. We do not know what this language was. We don't know the sophistication of language. We don't know anything about it, but we see evidence of, you know, different forms in Neanderthal culture.
they're like us in a lot of ways, but maybe they had different behaviors than us in other ways. You know, if you can describe, you know, Germans as being different than Italians in behavior and the way they interact, then certainly Neanderthals and sapiens were going to be very, very different in the way they certainly had behaviors. But whoever had this, they had a language, they had their own epics, their own stories. 300,000 years ago, there was different wildlife, whatever. That's all gone. That's all gone. Oof. You know, what did they call themselves? You know, what were the stories when they looked up, they told themselves they looked up the stars at the sky? Gone.
What did they replace stick with? We don't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, they didn't have stick. We had to invent stick because, yeah, you know, those guys pre-stick. But it just, you know,
just had wood.
Like, yeah. That's why I like these projects that try to record like indigenous people's folklores and stuff. But I think you could expand it to a lot of stuff. You know, there's a lot of cultures and new cultures and things like this where it's worth capturing, you know, just finding these things out. Like, you know, you try to find the roots of rock and roll. You know, you try to find out, like, you know, like, where, when did this start? Who started it? And some of these songs, like, oh, well, that was this song. Like, yeah, but this song was actually something that somebody was, you know, sung in New Orleans at this period, but we don't know where it came from. And, you know, even contemporary things like that have been sort of already lost.
Yeah, there was a, I forget which podcast I was listening to. I think it might have been the Dolly Parton one where they were talking about the beginning of murder ballads that through Appalachia. Like that those were very, very popular, and in many ways they were kind of the beginning of what we know now as like country music. But they have their origins in England, and it was basically somebody used to go, a bard basically used to go to places where murderers were sentenced, and then they would repurpose some of these songs to sing them about the murderer that was there. But this is something that, like, there's a shared history of that kind of musical folklore.
Wow.
Between you know, some parts of England and you know, the mountain areas of Appalachia.
Wow. All right, I'm gonna give Bryce, our music expert here, a question. Bryce, do you know what skiffle is?
Skiffle. Do I know
what skiffle?
I don't know what skiffle is.
So skiffle was sort of a style of kind of, was sort of an outgrowth of sort of like blues and jazz. there may have been Jewish people involved too.
Could have been.
Blues and jazz. It was an outgrowth of that. And a lot, if you go look at like Jimmy Page and whatnot, when he was young, when Jimmy Page was a real young boy, like there really wasn't rock, you know, there was skiffle and there was this sort of stand, and then rock sort of came sort of this thing along. But a lot of the British style of music, these guys were into skiffle, and then they sort of evolved into, you know, where, you know, what became, you know, the British rock invasion had a lot of its roots in that. And oh, wow. A lot of the music we listen to today was this period of skiffle was a thing, you know.
I feel like I remember us talking on, maybe it was a Night Attack pre-show, Justin, about the etymology of different words, like scat, not the other one, but like scatting, yeah. and trying to trace back. And that's, you know, skiffle is what, from the 20s, you said, the 20s and 30s?
Well, no, it would extend it. So there was a band called The Quarrymen, which was a skiffle band that, you know, very few people heard of. But the guy who started it went on to go form a band called The Beatles. And that was John Lennon.
Oh, wow.
You know, so John Lennon skiffle, you know, like a lot of these guys are British rockers. Got their start there, and then it was this evolution of all of a sudden some of the American sound and rock and whatnot, you know. And then, but it just, it's a very, you know, a thing that sort of gets lost.
Wow.
Anyhow, there's a really cool article in Ars Technica by Eric Berger, who is doing is a really good space journalist, and he went to go visit the SpaceX Boca Chica plant where they're working on Starship, and he visited like 2 days after. The SN1, that was the one that blew up, and, you know, got to talk to Elon about that. And it's a very, very cool thing because it's really a deep dive into what Elon is planning. And basically, Elon's not just talking about building a Starship like he did with Tesla. He is now trying to build a factory to build these Starships. And this is the crazy thing. I saw this in the forums before, this price thrown out there.
And I'm like, that's insane. I don't believe it. But like, this is literally out of Elon's mouth. The goal is to get the price per Starship. Now, this would be not including what we talked about before, like what it takes for, let's say, life support. But the basic ship itself, $5 million.
Wow.
Okay, because he wants to be producing some of these like one a week, two a week. He wants to be producing these things in mass. He really wants to create 1,000 of these things. He wants 1,000 starships.
Jesus.
And would be the entire a 1,000 would be the fleet, or they need to make thousands?
Well, I think keep making them. The idea is that he's like, if we want to call, and he's very serious about colonizing Mars, if you haven't picked up that up. And in doing that, it's not like, hey, we're going to build a ship to go there. He's like, no, we are going to build thousands of ships. And every period in which it's, you know, we can go to Mars, we go to Mars. Mm-hmm. You know,
is the plan to take the Tesla cars, right? All car manufacturers update the car lines every year, right? The 2018 Tesla X, the 2019 Tesla X, whatever. So, but these would not be 1,000 ships of the same blueprint, because I imagine they keep making all these technological advances and design advances, that this would be an evolving fleet of ship design over time.
Yes, Mark? There'd be change, but also it's like getting something into space is probably a little bit more of an engineering challenge than rolling out a car onto the road. So I would assume, yeah, I mean, they are all going to be made to order. Even if you're producing 1,000 of them, you're going to make sure that they are available to get to space.
Well, look at like what the Falcon 9 rocket. Okay, the Falcon 9 rocket they make today is way more advanced than the one they made 10 years ago. They've done things like they've stretched it a bit. The engines improved dramatically. They've learned a lot. And so they do versions of this, the V1, V2, V3, V4. And they do that with like Teslas, as you mentioned before. A Model 3, like I have a Model 3 from the first year they made it, and a Model 3 today, there's a lot of little improvements in there. Every now and then they'll go through a significant design change, you know, and they might change things over, like, you know, they haven't changed the battery pack or whatever, but, you know, enough that you could, you know, use parts from one to the other, but there are improvements made over time. And so what will happen with this is, you know, they went from SN1 to SN2, and they changed the way they did bulkheads and changed the way they did stuff. And they talk about how faster the second one was to build than the first one. Because the first one, you're like, hey, do we assemble these barrel units vertically, or do we do it on the ground? You know, how do we do this? Or what kind of welder do we use? And they've been building their own tools. There was a neat thing talking about how some engineers like, hey, we need a way to make these seams. And they designed their own tool in a matter of weeks and had this thing on the assembly line putting things together. And so now the step is to figure out your basic design, the size of the bulkheads, whatever, and then moving forward, like there'll be constant iterations, but, you know, okay. Think about that, 1,000 of those things.
Because I guess just in my mind, like the time it takes to make 1,000, by the time you hit number 1,000, you may need to start all over again to refurb or get rid of or update those existing ones. That's my thinking, to go from 1,000 to thousands.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, probably by version 10, or, you know, like the 10th one they've made, they'll probably have a pretty good idea, and you'll start to figure out what you do. You need to change the bulkheads or things like that? Probably not. Do you need to change that stuff? No. You know, are you going to change the kind of welds you use? Maybe on version, you know, that, whatever. But the goal is to mass produce them like cars, though, like airplanes or whatever. You know, you look at a modern Boeing airplane, you look at a modern passenger jet, and the shape, if you park this on a runway in, you know, 1970, it would look a little bit different, a little bit exotic, but it wouldn't be alien. Yeah. But once you opened up the engine and you looked at the engine and you stepped inside the cockpit and you saw the avionics, you'd be like, wow, this is something from the future.
Okay.
So cool, though. I mean, I just love that thinking. I love that thinking big.
Yeah.
Oh, hell.
How many launch sites does SpaceX have now? I mean, if they're looking at 1,000 ships, I can't imagine. You would also need to launch a lot of ships.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be, if you're going to Mars, it means that, you know, you've got once every 26 months is when is the optimal point to launch. So over spread out several weeks or several months, you would be launching a lot of them. As far as launch facilities now, they have Cape Canaveral, they have Vandenberg, and then Boca Chica, which is the one that they're going to wholly own, which they're going to launch from there. They've launched the Falcon 1 from, you know, a tiny little island in the Pacific, but as far as launch facilities, they're looking to do that. But, you know, that's another area of, you know, innovation is going to come down to think like, you know, what do you need to launch? You know, once you can have things take off from near where they're assembled, you can then launch them, and then you can have some other facility where you don't have a lot of the infrastructure for assembling them, but you may have infrastructure for storing them. But his goal is to get these things into space and keep them moving. Think big. Gentlemen, have any picks?
Yeah, I got a pick. Started watching the award-winning Amazon series Fleabag. Caught it on the flight coming back, and we've watched a couple more episodes since then. But Phoebe Waller-Bridge, very well done. I'm 5 episodes in. It is a well constructed show. A very main character that's got a lot going on. Not necessarily the most likable person, but as you kind of get through, you can understand where she's coming from.
I hear Fleabag is very good. That's all I know is that it's supposed to be very good. What is it about other than just being about Phoebe Waller-Briggs?
I mean, it's one of those things where the story is fairly simple. It's to describe it is to kind of give away some of the punch. But
oh, okay,
she is a hot mess, and she owns a cafe that's in dire financial straits. She comes from a very complicated family, and man, British people.
Very cool. Yeah, I've been interested. How far into Fleabag did you say you made it? A couple episodes?
I think we're at episode 5. I think there's like 2 8 episode seasons, and I think that's it. I think she had an option to do another one, and she decided not to.
How British!
I was gonna say. Very cool. Yeah, I've not seen that, but I'll
although apparently one. Now I guess she's involved. She was one of the writers of the new Bond movie.
Yeah, No Time to Die, screenplay by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. That's cool. I have two picks. I have two picks for weird things today. The first one, they're both kind of timely, but the first one is especially timely. It is the HBO show The Outsider, which just had its season finale last night. Hopefully series finale. I really dig this. This is based off the Stephen King book, adapted by Richard Price. And I think the ending is great. I think how they decide to confront the outsider and how they solve it is good. I think it's good. There are a couple of things around it that I don't like. There's a mid-credits scene, not a post-credits scene. There's a mid-credits scene that is stupid and doesn't need to happen, and it's annoying because it doesn't say anything about the story other than like, you like this character, don't you? What if we did more with this character? Would you want to see more of this character? Like very, very self-serving of a thing. Otherwise, I think the season has been great. It's 10 episodes on HBO. Have either of you guys caught any of The Outsider yet?
I have not.
No?
I've been hesitant because a lot of the adaptations and stuff are so uneven and usually not good.
Yeah.
But if you're saying it's good, then it might be worth checking out.
It is good. I think there's we talked about it on Spoiler in Time, so if anybody's interested, cordkillers.com. But I think there's only one or two episodes where I was really like, really didn't do anything this episode, kind of squat in the middle of the season. But the beginning and the end are both both bangs. My other pick is a new Netflix drama out of Japan called Followers. This is directed by Nina Mikagawa, I believe. Oh, I think I messed that up. But she's this great photographer who's done some directing before. But this is this big ensemble drama about creative people in a modern sort of social media age, from a professional photographer who is getting to be about middle age and knows that she wants a kid, but she's also having trouble in love. You've got a young actress who can only find jobs being a corpse on TV and would like to have real work, who gets boosted by this photographer and now has to deal with the sudden swelling of fame, plus other, like, it is a whole ensemble piece and everyone kind of gets, and it gets their story. I think it's really interesting, and for the genre of J dramas or K dramas, whatever, This doesn't feel like there's a certain look to those dramas and a certain writing style to those dramas that I think this breaks out of. And it's like super colorful. Every scene has got like tons of bloom and just saturation. Like all of the lighting is really strike, like, beyond all of the story stuff, it also just looks really incredible, which I think it kind of has to for a show where one of the main characters is a photographer and it's directed by this very this rather prolific photographer herself. So big recommendation for Followers on Netflix.
Awesome.
I have just a couple picks. One is I saw some discussion in the chat section here, which might mean some people at home might have some questions or comments, but there was a SpaceX presentation Elon Musk gave, which was the most recent Starship update, which I have a feeling we'll get another one. And that's where he goes and explains like how they're going to do in orbit refueling, whatever, because there's Starship and then there's Super Heavy, which is going to be the booster, which in the Eric Berger article, which I highly recommend, talks about Elon's like the booster is sort of the easy part, because they've been doing that in sort of a scale-up version of what they've been doing before. But yeah, how getting to Mars isn't just as easy as let's all hop in a rocket and do that. You launch the Starship up, and then you send up these boosters with refueling Starships that are basically attached to it, that are just fuel tanks to fuel it up, et cetera. And it's fascinating to see how the thinking behind this. My picks outside of that are, one, I saw Onward on Saturday and I thought it was really fun. It was, yes, an enjoyable film.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I would say that I haven't watched as many Pixar movies lately. I think they're all quite good, but they all kind of have a template now of this is going to be the emotional message you're going to get. Let's get to that emotional message. And yes, wasn't it fun getting to sort of, they're very linear, I guess I would say right now. A little bit too linear, perhaps.
Yeah. I caught Onward over the weekend, and I definitely, like, I walked out of it and I really enjoyed it, but I thought Andrew or Brian would tear this story apart because it is completely predictable, and it is very, there are not any surprises in how it goes.
Yeah, and that's, it's a beautifully designed world. It's a very interesting place they were in. And you watch the trailer and you're like, that is the story you're going to get. And, compared to I haven't watched a number of Pixar movies lately, because I just sort of think they've gone on a path, which I think is good. They're kind of like these kind of emotionally sort of meaning things, but often sometimes it does it really well. Like, I thought Coco was wonderful. Coco was exceeded my expectations and had surprises and was a really delightful film. This felt more sparse, in a sense. I liked this world and I would love to see more of this world. And if Pixar wanted to do, or Disney wanted to do, a TV series about these brothers in this place, I would be really onto it. I couldn't, if you watch the trailer, it's like they try to bring their father back and they only have the lower half of the dad, which was just weird.
it was just weird. It was just like, this is just a weird sort of thing, you know, of like, you know, thinking like a dude's crotch and legs are walking around. Like, this is just, couldn't it just been like his empty suit or something? It was just a weird, so such a weird take. That was the thing that kind of got to me. Like, this is such a weird choice. But the performances are great. You know, it's enjoyable. And if you want to go see a movie, there's not a lot out there to go see. I recommend it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like the imagery of Onward is like every scene kind of has like one moment you could take a still shot of, and just that still would tell you so much about just with, if you had no other story, you would be like captivated by the scene of like, oh, it's these elves, but one of them's wearing flannel and one of them is dressed like a little punk rock guy and they're eating Cheetos and they're also like in this grand Tolkien-esque plane, but there's definitely like a plane and a contrail in the sky. Like all sorts of like really cool. They do a good job of mixing that world together. That was the best part of it.
You're saying that it's so dense. Every frame.
Every frame's a painting.
And then the other thing is Narcos season two. Narcos Mexico season two.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's a great example of like, as Justin describes, where, you know, you're watching the good guys try to track down the bad guys, but watching the bad guy, and you don't want the fun to stop, you know, even though he's horrible. He's based on a real life person who was a horrible monster who murdered lots and lots of people. And here you're like, he's a bad guy, and you still feel bad for his friends, or you feel bad for, you know, the guy that he has to have killed, who, spoiler, ran a steamroller over a couple innocent people, but you're still like, oh, no, you killed him. Oh, he was such a good, no, he's not a good guy, but you're just,
he was a good character.
Yeah, so that's the beautiful thing about Mark. And it was, they went out of the way, though, it's sort of funny, because, like, they had one character where, like, you know, the protagonist, the cop, is like, oh, well, he wasn't a bad guy. No, this guy was a bad guy. He killed people. He did bad things. I know from the narrative of the story, you want to be like, oh, we should feel bad. Like, no, this guy was a monster. You know, it was one of these, like, you know, Sonoma crime lords who, you know, they had heart and fell in love and stuff. Like, yeah, still a monster. Fact. Yeah. But
still an awful, awful person.
Yeah, but still an enjoyable story, you know. But I mean, this is a story where, like, you're rooting, you're watching this and you're rooting for the industriousness of a young El Chapo. You know, you're like, man, I hope he gets to build this tunnel. So that's very well done in that regard. Very well done. Because it's not like they hide the fact that these people are murder and horrible people, but they just do it anyways. But you're still sort of pulled into their story.
So, does Narcos Mexico have the same plot device of Narcos where it's following a DEA agent?
Yep. No.
Is it still is it still like it is in Narcos? Where it's just, where it's like, what I mean is like where you have this very interesting subject and they are not the main character of the story.
I would say that the DE agent here is Scoot McNairy, which you get his character, you get into sort of his backstory bit, a little bit about what's going on in his life. But he's a really, I would say that in the first Narcos thing, like the DE agent was just sort of there kind of thing. And they did some stuff. And then here, and again, all these things, they take things that happened and they've created a fantasy narrative around it. You know, let's be quite honest with it. Like, things do not happen the way they're described, but the names are real and some of the broader strokes are real. But Scoot McNairy, I've always liked. He's a really neat actor. And so, you know, he's very compelling in it. So,
okay, cool. Narcos Mexico on Netflix.
Yeah. And my issue with like the first season or whatever of like Narcos, I think season one and two, was whenever they were at the task force, it just felt like a set. It just looked like a set. Mm-hmm. You know, it looked like something out of a telenovela, and you could sort of tell sort of which was, you know, you could sort of tell like how production sort of works down there and how that worked. Cause you're like, this lighting, everything, is nothing feels real. I don't feel like I'm in a real thing. There's a little bit, it's better here, but you still get some of that where you're like, you know, it's like still enjoyable. And I'm curious to see, like, Amazon has their own cocaine series now, like 000.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Coke Wars.
Coke Wars. America loves cocaine. So, you know.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.